Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Spin a globe to Northwest Africa and put your finger on Western Sahara. What you'll see looks like an independent country. Western Sahara is, after all, nearly as big as its northern neighbor, Morocco. In truth, this stretch of desert along the Atlantic Ocean may be Africa's most overlooked territorial dispute. Morocco seized control of most of Western Sahara in 1976. That followed the departure of the former colonial power, Spain. Morocco calls the territory its southern provinces, but no other nation officially recognizes Morocco's claim, and human rights violations within the ungoverned territory are rampant. Now, however, the world's attention is increasingly drawn to the decades-long dispute between Morocco and the Algerian-backed Polisario Front. The focus follows the French military intervention this year in Mali, which is two countries to the east from Western Sahara. The UN General Secretary and the French President both express fear that the rise of Islamic militancy in Mali could spread to the Western Sahara territory. Actually, as our guests on today's program will explain, the people in the ungoverned region practice a liberal form of Islam, and its refugee camps are led by women. Today on Global Journalist, the Western Sahara predicament. But first, World Watch. Syria's civil war returned to the forefront of public debate after evidence emerged that chemical weapons were used there. U.S. President Barack Obama had previously called the use of chemical weapons a red line. So the discovery raised the possibility of Western military intervention. Obama earlier this week remained neutral. He said it's still unknown how the chemical weapons were used, when they were used, and who used them. On Wednesday, health officials in Turkey said they're testing blood samples taken from Syrian casualties brought over the border from fighting in recent days. They're trying to determine whether they were victims of a chemical weapons attack. Western governments are wary of the false intelligence that was used to justify the 2003 war in Iraq, and Obama wants proof before taking action. Another hotspot, Libya, is flaring up again. A group of gunmen took over Libya's foreign ministry over the weekend. They blockaded the building with heavily armed trucks, and they're demanding that officials connected to the Gaddafi regime be banned from government jobs. The Justice Ministry was similarly surrounded on Tuesday, and other institutions, including the media, have been targeted. In Iran, oil sanctions imposed last year are eating into oil profits. The Financial Times reports that revenues tumbled to a three-year low. Iran is trying to counter the decline in its exports by raising oil prices. That strategy has effectively raised consumer gas prices in Asia and Europe. On the diplomatic front, President Vladimir Putin and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe held the first summit between their nations in a decade. They announced at the Kremlin that negotiations on a peace treaty will resume soon. The lingering World War II dispute over a group of islands has stood in the way of a formal peace pact. In Venezuela, tensions over the recent presidential election remain high. Demonstrations in the tens of thousands filled streets in the capital at midweek. There were marches by supporters of Nicolas Maduro and his mentor, the late President Hugo Chavez. At the same time, opposition candidate Enrique Capriles walked in a crowd of his supporters. The previous day, several opposition lawmakers were injured during a brawl on the floor of Congress. Capriles called for an end to the government crackdown on his backers, and he reiterated plans to challenge his narrow election loss in both Venezuela's court and eventually appeal to the international justice system. Elsewhere in South America, the Bolivian Constitutional Court declared that President Evo Morales can run for a third term next year. The court said Bolivia's 2009 constitution that allows for just one single re-election doesn't apply to Morales' first term. That's because the first election in 2005 was before the constitution was enacted, but opposition leaders questioned the court's independence. In the Netherlands, Queen Beatrix stepped down from her throne, and her eldest son, Willem-Alexander, was sworn in king. Willem is the first male to have the throne in more than 120 years in the Netherlands. The new monarchy is expected to be a little more laid back compared to its predecessors. The king has already announced that he should no longer be called Your Majesty. Finally, the president of Botswana was attacked, but it had nothing to do with politics. A cheetah slashed President Ian Khama in the face, and the wound required stitches. The president's bodyguard says the attack happened so fast it caught them both by surprise. That's it for World Watch. On our program today, to enlighten us about the situation in Western Sahara, our journalist Luis de Vega and Stephen Zunis, a University of San Francisco professor of politics and international studies. Luis de Vega is a Spanish newspaper reporter who was working as a correspondent in Morocco before the government banished him for his hard-hitting reporting. Stephen Zunis is the co-author of a book on Western Sahara. Welcome to Global Journalist.
It's great to be on. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's get up to date with the recent developments. The UN Security Council voted unanimously 7 days ago to keep a peacekeeping force in Western Sahara. But Stephen, the Security Council declined to require human rights monitoring in the disputed territory. So what happened?
Well, this is very disappointing. MINURSO is the only peacekeeping force in the entire world that does not have human rights mandate in terms of monitoring what goes on in the area they're supposed to be in charge of. And there have been periodic attempts to try to rectify that. And there was some real hope this time because the Obama administration, in a break from previous administrations, both Republican and Democrat, announced that they would propose a resolution that would remove MINURSO for the next 6 months and include, this time, a human rights mandate. But unfortunately, a combination of pressure from France, which is Morocco's closest ally, Morocco itself, which canceled a long-planned joint military exercise with U.S. forces, as well as pro-Moroccan elements within Congress and the State Department, forced Obama to back off on this, and they went ahead and renewed the mandate once again without a human rights monitoring function.
Okay. And Luis, there was a pro-independence protest last weekend in Western Sahara's largest city. Could you tell us what happened?
Well, what we have seen is that Sahrawi people feel really tired of all that has happened in the last year. Because of this, hundreds of people, essentially in the capital, El Aaiún, but also in another city, such as Bojador, started Thursday night and Friday last week different rallies to demand more attention from the international community and to express they hope to be independent. So as usual, the Moroccans repress all these rallies, and even today, 5-6 days after, there are still protests in different cities, and we have dozens of people hurt in different hospitals, and there is official communicate from the Moroccan government telling that at least 70 policemen from their side have been hurt as well.
Wow, so that's a pretty violent conflict. So the Moroccan police came in and broke up the demonstrations?
Well, this is what happens very often. All these kind of rallies in the streets has been taking place for a long time, even in the years of Spain, before the Green March in 1975. But I don't know how to explain it in English. It is like a pendulum. It is go and back. So we had In 2005, what we call the Sahrawi Intifada, it was a very hard year. And from time to time, we have people going out to the street and showing their hope to be independent and demanding at the same time, not only for the human rights, but also to press the United Nations to organize the referendum in which the Sahrawis can decide which is going to be their future.
Right. Well, I want to get back to the conditions on the ground, but I also want to take a step back now and provide some historical perspective. Stephen, the subtitle of the book on Western Sahara is a war, nationalism, and conflict irresolution. That kind of sums up what's going on. Could you give us some of the key plot points?
Well, the main problem is that Morocco has powerful friends, including France and the United States, which are permanent members of the UN Security Council, which have the veto power, which means that the whole series of UN Security Council resolutions, initially insisting that Morocco withdraw its occupation forces that they brought into the country during their 1975 invasion, and more recent resolutions calling on Morocco to allow for a free and fair referendum, they haven't been enforced. And it's quite disturbing because, you know, there are a lot of complex conflicts around the world and dealing with ethnicity and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But this is a clear-cut case of aggression. This is a case of a non-self-governing territory that's been denied its right to self-determination, that's been invaded and occupied by a powerful neighbor. And, uh-huh. You know, if the international community cannot take the appropriate action in something as clear-cut as this, how can we expect to deal with the more complex issues?
Right.
This is, and so really, it's so far been a triumph of realpolitik, of might makes right, regardless of international law or of even the most basic standards of human rights. The good news, though, and I think the only hope we really have, is both the ongoing resistance of the people of Western Sahara, who mostly nonviolently, but at least without arms, have been struggling in recent years within the territory to try to get their basic rights, including the right of self-determination. And a growing movement, particularly in Europe, we're starting to see more elsewhere as well, of civil society organizations really pressing their governments to change their support for the Moroccan occupation. This is what eventually freed East Timor, the former Portuguese colony that was occupied by Indonesia for so many years. And so I really think the only real hope we have is global civil society.
Right. And Luis, you're heading to the region next week. Why now?
I try to go every time I have the possibility. So next week, the Polisario Front is organizing an agenda because of the 40th anniversary of its foundation. You know, the Polisario Front is a political organization, the Sahrawi government, we can call it, and right. It's based essentially in the part of the Western Sahara that is under the control of the Sahrawis, and also in the refugee camps of Tindouf in the south of Algeria. The Polisario Front has the main issue is to press for the independence of the territory. And even as the President Mohamed Abdelaziz has recognized me several times, independence is even before democracy. So some people from Morocco and other countries are accusing the Polisario Front not to be a democracy organization, but Abdelaziz and the ministers of the Polisario recognize that first of all is independence and then democracy. So I think a lot of young people from the Sahrawi camps are far from the government, and this can in the next future a problem to organize the agenda for the Polisario. So I want to see next week in the ground, mm-hmm. is there something changing inside of the Polisario? Because I'm afraid with Abdelaziz being president for more than 30 years, it's not an image that something is changing in the conflict.
And I want to get people to kind of visualize what the situation there is. Stephen, can you talk about the divisions within the country where you have the Morocco has control, where the occupied region, where the Polisario Front is basically running things, and then the refugee camps. So what's it like there now? You've been there several times.
Well, the Sahrawis have traditionally been a nomadic, and they've never wanted any kind of outside control. They were never part of the Ottoman Empire. They're historically a free people, and even Morocco, during the height of its empire in the 19th century, never really controlled the territory. And the Spaniards, who had laid claim to that area for a long time, only attacked by the interior in the late 1950s. So they really their history of resistance to foreign domination is very much in their blood. When the Moroccans invaded in 1975, they were so brutal that nearly half the population fled and ended up in refugee camps just across the border in Algeria. And the armed struggle that the Polisario waged against the Moroccans succeeded within 7 years of liberating close to 85% of the territory. But thanks to massive American and French rearmament and training, including the presence of the special forces in the occupied territory itself, the Moroccans were able to reverse the tide of the war. And by building a giant separation wall, essentially this 1,200-mile pair of sand berms in the desert, they basically forced the Polisario to only about 20% of the westernmost parts of the, or sorry, easternmost parts of the country, where there's virtually no towns or natural resources or anything right. like that. Meanwhile, the remaining population has been under Moroccan occupation, and speaking as someone who's been to over 60 countries, right. including Iraq under Saddam and Indonesia under Suharto, I've never seen a worse police state anywhere. Right. And even though Morocco itself has liberalized somewhat under the current king, the situation in the occupied territories is very severe indeed.
Right. That sounds incredible. Now, Luis, when people hear about this occupied territory, I mean, it sounds a little bit like a combination of the Berlin Wall and the West Bank, but there's probably a better analogy, isn't there? Maybe East Timor?
I have never been in East Timor, but I have been at about 20 times in Western Sahara, and what you see, not only in the ground but also outside, is that one of these kind of forgotten conflicts we have in the world. Now, on the ground, inside of the Western Sahara controlled and occupied by Morocco, but by Morocco, you see that the population is more today more settlers than what we can say Sahrawis. In the last 20, 30 years, Rabat has pushed a lot of people to go to live in Western Sahara. So even if they make both sides, Sahrawis and Moroccans, separate lives, if there are some Sahrawi people supporting Rabat in the conflict, you can see a lot of police and a lot of them in plain clothes in the street. And the situation in the normal life is not really calm, usually.
Right. Now, speaking of the international scope, I'll ask Stephen first, and then Luis, you can answer the same question. But how realistic are concerns that the conflict in Mali will spill over to the Western Sahara? Stephen?
Well, the threat from Al-Qaeda in Maghreb is real in terms of Mali, southern Algeria, Niger, perhaps Mauritania. I think Western Sahara is one place I think that's relatively safe for a number of reasons. First of all, the Polisario has always been a decidedly secular and leftist center kind of liberation movement. And they control the camps pretty thoroughly. If there was any al-Qaeda-type infiltration, they would find out about it pretty soon and root it out. The other thing is that the area where the refugee camps are in a military zone for the Algerian government, and the Algerians, of course, had this bloody civil war in the 1990s against Islamist extremists, and they would certainly not allow penetration of those kinds of groups. But I think more fundamentally, the Sahrawi, while devoutly Muslim, have traditionally practiced a fairly liberal kind of Islam that would just the antithesis of the really hardcore Salafist, misogynist, violent kind of interpretation of Islam we normally associate with al-Qaeda and similar groups. I mean, just for example, Sahrawi women have equal rights to inheritance and divorce, so keep their maiden names. There's a belief that religious practice is between the individual and God, not something for some temporal authority to impose a particular rigid interpretation. So that this kind of Islam just would never really take off among the Sahrawis. And also, I should note that even during the 15 years of the armed struggle, the Polisario never engaged in any acts of terrorism. They targeted Moroccan military and economic targets exclusively. They quite consciously avoided civilians. So for that reason as well, I can't imagine that the kind of ideology and practices of al-Qaeda would get much of a following.
Okay, now before we wrap up the program, I want to remind everyone that you can listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts from the website globaljournalist.org. Our website now features a Western Sahara timeline, profiles, and a compilation of social media components about the dispute. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter @globaljourn. Now, Luis, are you any more optimistic or more pessimistic now about what's happening there?
Talking about Western Sahara, I think it's really very difficult to be optimistic. Real politics nowadays is not working for the solution with the side of the law, but just they are working for another kind of solution. So I should be optimistic if I could feel the international community and the United Nations working in the right direction. But even if they are talking nowadays about human rights, I think they are not thinking in a solution in the right side.
Okay. And finally, Luisa, your closing comment on what makes these people different than the other people in the area and what your hopes are for them.
Okay. All these people in the desert, they are organized by tribes. It's not easy to talk with them about borders. A lot of people is still nomads. But I think the point is not what makes them different. The point in this conflict is how have we reached this situation. Mm-hmm. So this is the oldest colony in the whole Africa. It's still under pressure. It's a Spanish colony. And Morocco, Algeria, Spain, Mauritania, United Nations, they have to see and to look at solutions for this non-self-government territory. This is, it's, I think think it's not a matter who is the people living in the Sahrawi territory, settlers or Sahrawis or Spanish people. So the point is, we have organized it, the wall based in a rules. The rules are accepted by everybody now playing the match. Even if Moroccan diplomacy is winning the match, I think we have to respect the laws.
Yes.
And the rules of the match are not being respected nowadays.
Okay.
So if we are set to play the match under the United Nations, we have to respect. And a lot of people is not respecting the rules, the resolutions. So the referendum should be organized. Because of this, I think it's not the point who are the Sahrawis. The point is, what can we do to reach a fair solution?
Okay. Now, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a very enlightening conversation about a real international predicament. Now, Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Sravani Pair was our lead producer for this program, with assistance from Nassim Benchaban, Eliza Lopez Aguado, and Ali McIntyre. Stay with us for Free Press Watch, and please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, Global Journalist's weekly rundown of the major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Nassim Benchaban. The news this week comes from the New York Times, Reporters Without Borders, the Committee to Protect Journalists, Freedom House, CNN, and the BBC. Iraqi government officials pulled the operating licenses of 10 television stations, including Al Jazeera, after accusing the networks of contributing to growing sectarian violence in the country. Sunni-led unrest and turmoil resulted in about 180 deaths in the previous week after Shiite-led government forces violently cracked down on Sunni protesters in the city of Hawija, killing 23 people. The Iraqi Communication and Media Commission said the networks had, quote, exaggerated things, given misinformation, and called for breaking the law and attacking Iraqi security forces. The suspensions appear to target mainly Sunni television networks critical of Iraq's government and Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. American filmmaker Timothy Tracy was arrested by Venezuelan authorities and accused of working for U.S. intelligence services. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro ordered the detention of Tracy, who arrived in the country 2 years prior to document the political situation. Interior Minister Miguel Rodriguez Torres said he had video footage shot by Tracy that shows the filmmaker taking part in violent protests after the presidential election. Tracy will face terrorism charges at a court hearing May 3rd. Authorities in Kazakhstan seized copies of a new opposition newspaper before it could be distributed on April 24th. The inaugural issue of the paper, titled The Truthful Newspaper, contained an interview with the country's Communist Party leader and pieces from a book about an opposition figure. The newspaper plans to attempt publication again next month. For more information on these stories and other issues concerning press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Nassim Benchaban. We'll see you next week.
From Belarus to Bahrain, Global Journalist brings you the major news from around the world. Each week, we take a look at a different story involving press freedom or foreign relations. To submit questions, comments, or show suggestions, please email us at globaljournalist@kbia.org. And tune into KBIA Thursday evenings at 6:30 to listen to the show. For more information, please visit our website, globaljournalist.org/radio.